Hey, future doctors. Welcome back to Spoonful of Sugar. We have an amazing episode in store for you today on a much-needed topic. Let's let the hosts introduce themselves and take it away.
Hey, future doctors. Thanks for tuning in to Spoonful of Sugar, a podcast made for medical students by medical students to help the medicine go down. My name is Sahil Sirdesai. I'm a third-year medical student at Penn State, and I'll be your host for today. Throughout the session, I'll be asking a lot of questions, so feel free to pause and think about the answer choices if you need. We'll start today's session with the vignette. You're rotating through the emergency department when you see a 20-year-old female hunched over the exam table appearing in acute distress. She has had vague abdominal pain for the past 8 hours, but the pain has recently localized to the right lower quadrant region over the past 2 hours. The patient describes the pain as a sharp, stabbing pain, and she has to hunch over when walking because the pain is so severe with movement. Her past medical history is unremarkable. Vitals are normal other than a moderate fever of 38.2 degrees Celsius. And physical exam shows right lower quadrant tenderness with moderate guarding and pain with flexion and internal rotation of the hip. What do you think the most likely diagnosis is? So this is a pretty classic description of appendicitis. Appendicitis is the most common abdominal emergency with a lifetime incidence of roughly 7%, so there's a good chance that you're bound to see it at some point during rotations and on your board exams. In today's session, I'll cover the topic of appendicitis and mimics for the frequently tested diagnosis. So just to review the pathogenesis of appendicitis, appendicitis is a condition that most commonly appears in the second and third decades of life and is characterized by inflammation of the appendiceal wall, which can lead to perforation, abscess formation, or peritonitis if left untreated. Although the exact cause is unknown, it's generally theorized that obstruction of the appendix is the most common and likely etiology. The most common cause for adults being fecalith, or hard stool, obstruction, and the most common cause in children being lymphoid hyperplasia, or enlargement of surrounding lymph tissue. Lymphoid hyperplasia can cause a compressive effect and increase the intraluminal pressure, impair blood, lymph, and mucus flow, and lead to a bacterial overgrowth causing the surrounding infection or inflammation. Although there are other potential causes for appendicitis, such as appendiceal calculi, which is basically mineral deposits, infectious processes, and compressive masses, such as carcinoid tumors, the most frequently tested etiologies are fecalith and lymphoid hyperplasia, but it's good to understand that any compressive, inflammatory, or irritation to the appendix can result in appendicitis. Do you know why appendicitis can initially present with central or periumbilical pain before localizing to the right lower quadrant region? If you're thinking that initial pain is due to the inflamed appendix stimulating the visceral afferent nerve fibers at the T8 to T10 levels before causing localized peritoneal inflammation, then you're correct. So in addition to this migratory pain, what are some other common clinical symptoms of appendicitis? Common symptoms include nausea, vomiting, indigestion, changes to bowel movements, so either constipation or diarrhea, bloating, and mild fevers or chills. What are some physical exam tests that are specific to appendicitis diagnoses? Specific tests include McBurney's point tenderness, which is 2/3 of the distance from the umbilicus to the right side asis, Rosing's sign, which is pain in the right lower quadrant with palpation of the left lower quadrant, the Psoas sign, which is right lower quadrant pain with passive right hip extension, and then the obturator sign, which is right lower quadrant pain with right hip flexion followed by internal rotation. Diagnosis of appendicitis is based on the combination of clinical presentation and supporting imaging and lab findings. What do you think is typically the preferred imaging modality for suspected appendicitis? If you're thinking of an abdominopelvic CT, then that's correct. Positive findings on CT would include wall thickening and other signs of irritation or inflammation. Although CT is the general preferred modality, if your test question involves a child or someone that's pregnant, then make sure to pick ultrasound as your preferred imaging of choice as it avoids radiation and contrast exposure. Although ultrasound has less diagnostic accuracy for appendicitis, you should still be able to see increased echogenicity of the appendix, which would be a sign for appendicitis. So let's say you have a patient presenting to the ED with initial vague central abdominal pain that has recently transitioned to the right lower quadrant region. They have a positive McBurney's point tenderness and a positive Rousing sign test when applying pressure to the left lower quadrant. But CT scan of the abdomen shows no appendiceal inflammation and only some enlarged mesenteric lymph nodes. What do you think is going on here? So hopefully you caught that this shouldn't be appendicitis because of the negative CT findings. I was purposefully trying to trick you because they'll try and do this on your NBME exams. This vignette is actually trying to point you towards pseudoappendicitis or infectious ileocystitis. Pseudoappendicitis is most commonly caused by Campylobacter and Yersinia infections. Pain can also be migratory, similar to appendicitis if the jejunum is the initial site for infection before traveling towards the ileocecal junction. Although stool studies, so PCR and or culture, are diagnostic for a pseudoappendicitis, imaging studies can show ileocecal inflammation and or mesenteric adenopathy with sparing of the appendix, which should be the key hint to help you differentiate between the two. Yersinia is the most common pathogenic cause of pseudoappendicitis. Do you know the risk factors for transmission? So the key buzzwords for Yersinia transmission are undercooked pork and unpasteurized milk, although you can also contract it from interacting with contaminated feces as well. Campylobacter is the second most common cause of pseudoappendicitis. Do you know how it's most commonly transmitted? Hopefully, you're thinking about undercooked poultry for this case, and treatment typically just involves supportive care. Let's do another question. A 35-year-old woman presents to the emergency department with a 24-hour history of worsening right lower abdominal pain. The pain was initially diffuse, but has now localized to the right lower quadrant and is worse with movement. She reports nausea, intermittent vomiting, and a low-grade fever. Physical examination reveals a positive McBurney's point test and a small, tender bulge that becomes more pronounced when the patient stands up. What is your leading differential here? This patient likely has some sort of hernia due to the bulge that appears with the Valsalva maneuver. Hernias are basically a protrusion of an organ through a body wall. Hernias can be congenital, which is due to an abdominal wall defect that's present at birth, or they can also be acquired due to weakening of the abdominal wall fibromuscular tissue. Of all hernias, roughly 75% are inguinal, with 2/3 of those being of the indirect subtype and 1/3 being of the direct subtype. Inguinal hernias are more commonly seen in men, while femoral hernias are more commonly seen in women patients. Although smaller and asymptomatic hernias can typically be treated with conservative management and watchful monitoring, surgery is sometimes indicated to prevent serious medical complications. Do you know what these might be? One complication is an incarcerated or obstructed bowel, which is essentially when the intestine gets caught in the abdominal bulge, and this can be serious as it can lead to obstruction and a compromise to blood flow, which can result in necrosis. This strangulation or vascular compromise can also lead to a bowel perforation, which is a medical emergency. Now let's do another question. You see a 26-year-old female in the ED with severe lower abdominal pain in the right lower quadrant that just started in the past 2 hours. She is currently hemodynamically unstable with a heart rate of 150 and blood pressure of 80 over 40, and her skin seems pale. She is currently feeling extremely dizzy and unable to answer a lot of questions, but she does mention that she has had mild abdominal pain for the past 2 months and some continuous light vaginal bleeding over that time that's uncharacteristic of her menses. What do you think's going on here? So hopefully you're thinking about some OB-GYN-related emergency here because of the vaginal bleeding and severe pain. For this question, I was trying to get you to think of a ruptured ectopic pregnancy because of the severe, sudden onset, hemodynamic instability, and the abnormal vaginal bleeding and missed menses. What would be your first step in management for a situation of ruptured ectopic pregnancy? So this patient needs immediate surgery to attempt to save structures like the fallopian tubes. Now let's say you get a similar patient that's presenting for an acute lower right quadrant pain that's been remitting every 2 hours over the past 24 hours, but is a 10 out of 10 in intensity when the pain presents. She has normal vitals, a negative pregnancy test, and no other symptoms. You do an abdominal and pelvic ultrasound and see a normal abdomen with an enlarged edematous right ovary and a slightly tilted uterus. Doppler shows normal arterial flow to the right ovary, but decreased venous return. What diagnosis are you thinking of here? Hopefully the last sentence was the tip-off towards an ovarian torsion diagnosis. Although NBME is trying to get creative now and avoid this buzzword, if you see the phrases decreased venous flow or asymmetric vascular flow to an ovary, you should be looking to pick an option that relates to ovarian torsion. Ovarian torsion occurs when the ovary twists around a ligament that it's suspended by, and the kink causes a flow obstruction, most commonly venous, leading to edema and a potential for infarction. The NBME might get creative and try to trick you by showing a normal Doppler ultrasound because this twisting is due to laxity or hypermobility of the ligaments, and so the ovary can also unkink itself. So essentially, although decreased venous blood flow is a good buzzword to pick an option for ovarian torsion, just because the Doppler ultrasound is normal doesn't mean that the patient can't have an ovarian torsion diagnosis. So now let's say you have a 28-year-old pregnant patient at 23 weeks gestation presenting with progressively worsening, sharp, right upper quadrant pain and associated nausea, vomiting, and constipation. Her vitals are completely stable and physical exam is unrevealing other than pain and a rebound tenderness in the right upper quadrant. Labs show a leukocytosis to 16,000 but are otherwise normal including the rest of the CBC and LFT test. What do you think might be going on here? So hopefully you didn't get caught up on the location of the pain because this was actually supposed to be a vignette for appendicitis. Although appendicitis is classically in the right lower quadrant, in pregnant patients, the growing uterus can actually displace the appendix upwards into the right upper quadrant. So if all of the other signs are pointing to appendicitis, just remember this exception to the rule. Some of you might have thought about a liver, gallbladder, or even pancreatic pathology, but just remember that you'd most likely have some abnormal LFT marker for these cases. And in this patient, the LFTs were all completely normal. Now, how would you treat appendicitis in a pregnant patient? Are there any special considerations that you need to take into account? So you'd treat it the exact same way. Ideally with a surgical approach, you might be on heightened alert for monitoring the mother and fetus since complications to delays in treatment are more severe than compared to a non-pregnant patient, but the treatment plan is the exact same. Let's do another question. You see a 25-year-old male patient at a rural clinic with suspected appendicitis as evidenced by right lower quadrant pain for the past 10 hours, a positive McBurney's point, an ileocoeus sign, and leukocytosis on labs. Due to financial problems with insurance coverage, the patient would like to delay an appendectomy for at least 1 week, so you decide to treat with the course of antibiotics in the meantime. Which of the following would be the most appropriate management for treatment? Would it be 1, doxycycline, 2, nitrofurantoin, 3, oral vancomycin, or 4, piptazo? So if you picked option 4, that is correct. Piptazo provides broad-spectrum coverage against both anaerobic and aerobic bacteria, making it a great choice for appendicitis treatment. Reviewing why the other answers are wrong, doxycycline doesn't have great anaerobic coverage, nitrofurantoin is pretty much only used for the treatment of UTIs, and oral vancomycin is only used in one situation. Do you know what that situation is? C. diff. If you see oral vancomycin as a treatment option, just remember that it's exclusively used for C. diff infections. So that last patient had to delay appendicitis treatment, but what are some complications of appendicitis? So essentially, why do you need relatively immediate treatment for a confirmed diagnosis? The most common complication is a ruptured or burst appendix, and this is a severe situation because it can lead to peritonitis, which is a potentially life-threatening scenario, as it can cause a septic shock immune response. Essentially, a ruptured appendix allows intraluminal bacteria to invade into the peritoneum, and they can then invade the bloodstream, leading to the life-threatening complication. Most of the complications of delayed appendicitis treatment relate to the hemodynamic and infectious sequelae of either rupture or abscess formation, which is why appendicitis is considered a medical emergency. So just to recap today's session, appendicitis is the most common abdominal emergency resulting from anything that compresses, irritates, or inflames the appendix. Patients will commonly present with right lower quadrant pain, nausea, vomiting, and mild fever. Lab findings might show leukocytosis and elevated inflammatory markers, while imaging, so ultrasound or CT, may show an enlarged, thick-walled appendix, periappendiceal fat stranding, or calcified obstructive deposits. The primary treatment is surgical removal of the appendix, but in some cases, antibiotics alone may be used initially, especially if surgery is contraindicated. And then don't forget to consider your differentials if the clinical picture seems a little wonky. So remember to consider the onset and severity of symptoms, the potential for pregnancy, and other associated symptoms that might point towards an alternate diagnosis where they might try and trick you into picking an appendicitis. Thank you for listening. If you found this episode helpful, please subscribe to our podcast. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, visit our website at spoonfulofsugar.org and post them under the link for this episode. Good luck with studying, and remember that if you ever have an SOS moment while studying, Spoonful of Sugar is always here to help the medicine go down.